This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn. I'm Chua Antik. My guest today is John Walter, the president-elect of the International Organization for Standardization, better known by its acronym ISO. Since its founding in 1947, it has developed and published more than 20,000 standards for everything from food safety and computers to healthcare and agriculture. John is here in Malaysia to speak at the ISO's 39th Consumer Policy Committee meeting. Thank you for taking the time to come on the show as well.
Thank you for having me here.
John, I'd like to start at the beginning. Why was an organization like the ISO needed?
Well, we depend on standards for our everyday life. Standards form the basis of our society. If we didn't have standards, we would have to create them. When we get up in the morning, we know that electricity will work. When we turn on the light, it will work, and we won't be electrocuted. We know if we're using an elevator or an escalator that it's safe. We know if we're using blood products that they're safe. We know if we're creating a product to sell internationally that it meets international standards. So every part of our life is driven by standards.
How do we know that it's safe?
We know it's safe because we create standards, bringing together the technical experts. So every standards committee has experts who know how to manufacture a product, know how to design the product, know how to use it, know how to maintain it, take it out of service. And then we have another separate system where we certify the product against that standard. And because we have consumers and government and industry on all of these technical committees, we produce the best standards in the world.
You said after getting elected that ISO is important for innovation and trade. How does standards support innovation and international trade?
We are in Canada, where I'm also head of the National Standards Body. We recognize, as do many other countries, that, and we'll use Malaysia as an example. You, I'm absolutely certain, have people in this country who come up with innovative products, something new. If they want to sell that, they need somebody to say that product is safe, that it meets the needs that it says it's meeting. So if you and I came up with a new innovative product for microphones and we wanted to sell that, our best way of doing that would be to have the International Committee on Microphones recognize our new innovative product. Then when we want to sell it, we've opened it up to a whole global market, not just Malaysia, but the whole world, because we can now say our new microphone, innovative product, meets the international standard.
So it's driven by business and ideas.
Absolutely. And instead of, some people think that standards stifle innovation. No, they help, they enable, they enhance innovation. In Canada, we're quite convinced that we have a number of new products and new services, and we have reached out to our industries, the same as you could in Malaysia, to say to those industries, what new product do you have that the whole world would want, and that then we can create that international standard or be part of an already created international standard so that new product can be sold. The same thing will apply to Malaysia. You will have a lot of people in this country who are bright, who are intelligent, who come up with new ideas. Let's talk to them and find out how do we make that into an international product that nobody else has thought of.
If the process is driven by businesses, how do you prioritize consumers' interest and their safety?
Well, part of it is through this whole week we have here in Malaysia, the Consumer Policy Committee of ISO. It's very important. We want to hear from them what they believe are the pressing issues for consumers. We also ensure that in many of our technical committees, consumers sit on those technical committees. So it's not just made up of the people who understand the product and know how to make it and maintain it. It's driven also by the consumer who uses it. So I can give you a sense of Kapolco. This committee was responsible in bringing forward issues such as secondhand goods. Can we create a standard as to how secondhand goods would be dealt with around the world? or adventure tourism is another one. Social responsibility, it used to be called corporate social responsibility. It's now a guidance document on social responsibility. That all came forward from consumers. So we ensure that consumers have a voice in many, many of our standards.
And this year's theme is road safety, and the Volkswagen scandal in 2015 comes to mind when I think about standards and self-regulation. Can we trust self-regulation? Because once you set the standard, how can we assume that the businesses or stakeholders would adhere to them?
Yeah, that's a good question. Self-regulation, where industries adopt a standard, is very successful because they want to sell a product. Volkswagen, I mean, what happened at Volkswagen, they blatantly moved away from a standard. None of us can stop that. But if they commit to following the standard, then there's another process that would come in that would certify the product. So the standard, we always say one standard, one test, accepted everywhere. So if a car is created to a standard, the Volkswagen should have that one standard. There should be one test to ensure they meet the standard, and then everybody should accept them. And the industry will be driven, because if they don't do that, they won't sell their product. Now, it's different if a government has a standard and adopts that into law. You have the ability here in Malaysia, your minister of it's innovation and science. I've forgotten the rest of the science, technology, and innovation. There, thank you. We'll do this okay together. that minister has the ability to adopt a standard into law, and it now becomes the law of the country. So that moves away from what you might call self-regulation.
So that is how you rely on governments to take up the standards and turn it into pieces of legislation as well.
Yes, and that's very much when it's issues of safety or issues of health. If ISO has standards for elevators, has standards for many, many products, and more countries are adopting the international standard. If the international standard provides a safe and usable product, there's no value in creating a standard for a product that's only applicable in Malaysia. It reduces the market for somebody making the equipment. It also means it might be more difficult for you to bring in equipment from outside the country because it meets a different standard. So if we, in Canada, we have seen, and I assume you would find the same thing in Malaysia, we have seen a reduction in the specific Canadian standards. Because an elevator is an elevator, and there's really no need for us to have standards that are so different from the rest of the world. So if we can reduce the number of specific Canadian or Malaysian standards, we should see a rise in the number of international standards that our governments are using. It makes it easier to bring in new product, it makes it easier to maintain it, and it provides a higher level of safety around the world.
There are about 163 countries that are member to ISO.
Yes.
And there are over 190 countries in the world. Who are the holdouts?
Oh.
and why?
Okay. That's a good question, but I don't think I should identify individual
countries.
Yes, I know.
I don't expect you to go through 30 over countries as well.
It's smaller countries that really probably don't have an ability to engage with ISO. It takes a certain amount of technical expertise. It takes some support from your government or your industries, particularly governments. But it's really smaller countries that really don't want or don't have the ability to be involved internationally. They are quite happy in taking international standards that maybe have been developed by neighboring countries. It's a very small group.
I'm speaking today to John Walter, the president-elect of ISO. Up next, I'll ask him more about how ISO can help developing economies like ours here in Malaysia. You're listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. This is Live and Learn. Good afternoon. I'm Chua Entik. If you've just joined us, my guest today is John Walter, president-elect of the International Organization for Standardization, better known as ISO. John, you're the president-elect. You'll be starting your two-year term in January 2018. What is the role of the president? What do you hope to achieve?
Let me back up a little bit just to explain that I have been involved in the governance of ISO for a number of years. So I have been a member of the ISO Technical Management Board, which supervises the creation of all of ISO standards. I was vice president policy for 3 years and president-elect now and then president for the next two. I have a really deep interest in assisting developing countries. In my term as president, I have a number of personal goals. First is the governance of the organization, which is, unless you're involved in it, probably boring, but that's ensuring that it is the proper and modern governance of any large organization. But the second goal for me is to really engage with developing countries. There are many things that we can do to build capacity in developing countries. In many developing countries, the national standards bodies are parts of government. And they're always faced with lack of resources. They're always subject to government restrictions and lack of budget applications and appropriations. And so I want to assist developing countries, the national standards bodies, to raise the awareness of ISO within their governments. The more that governments understand the value of standards, the more they will want to ensure that their technical experts, the people of their countries, are involved in those standards. So when the standards are created, they can be used in Malaysia. So that's it's raising the awareness of the value of standards, the international standards within each government. And that's always a challenge because standards work really well. We don't often have a crisis in the standards world. And so to get the attention of politicians who are really busy and doing other important work is a challenge. So mine is to go, like I'm doing right now, speaking to the minister of MOSTI, speaking to other senior people in this government and saying, you've got a really good national standards body, support it, make sure that Malaysians are on the international stage.
Because I think this is a very important priority. Food scandals or poisoning is the last thing that a minister or politician want to be faced with. So what are the obstacles that you've faced in persuading them to support the standards agencies?
They have an overwhelming number of priorities, and I would not want to be a politician because you're driven by so many different interests. As I just said, there really aren't there are very few crises in the standards world. The system works really well. You know, all of the equipment you've used today, if you came up the elevator, if you drove your car, or you got on a public transport, or you used a bank card, all of those things work really well, and we just think they're going to keep working well. And so for governments that are faced with an emergency, flooding or unemployment or a health issue, that comes first. It's the standards take a little while. It's not a hot topic. There are not many politicians get elected because they're supporters of standards. So it's getting their attention so they know if the standard systems fail, that's when there will be a problem. So it's putting the support in to ensure that the technical experts develop the best standards.
Can you take us through the process of what it takes to develop a standard?
Certainly. Well, let's look at it from a national point of view. Let's look at it from Malaysia's point of view. If there was a need identified for a standard in a certain area that the government wanted to regulate, the first thing they would assess is whether such a standard existed internationally. There's no point, as I've said, in creating one for Malaysia if there's already one outside that can be used in the country. But in any country, almost anyone can request that a standard be considered, come forward with any number of issues. In Canada, we had one person who was interested in increasing the safety of helmets for snowboarders. And that person was really persistent and continued to push with governments. And I know it's not a snowboarding isn't a big deal in Malaysia, but this person was very persistent in going forward and saying, we want this standard. There was an assessment. Was there a standard anyplace else? No. So then there would be a committee put together of interested people. In Canada, it was people who were aware of head injuries from snowboarders. It would be manufacturers of helmets. It would be the same as instead of snowboarding, let's look at bicycles in Malaysia and a helmet. Is there a need for a helmet? Is the current helmet satisfactory? If it's not, who knows best about that helmet to improve the standard? But it would also include consumers. So you bring together consumers who use helmets, the designers, the manufacturers, the people who test them, who drop them and see if they crack, that kind of thing. And the experts would take a period of time, write the requirements of that standard. They would also then seek public input. Have they missed anything? Is there anything else that needs to be added to that standard? And then subsequently it would be accepted, and if the government felt it was important enough and made it a law, then they would say this standard is now part of the law of Malaysia and everybody is required to wear a helmet that meets that standard.
And I read that this standard would be achieved once there is a consensus. What does a consensus mean? Does it have to be unanimous among all the experts on the technical committee?
Good question. You've read your information very well. Consensus means that all comments must be considered and resolved. So it doesn't mean it's unanimous. But if there are 20 people on a committee and a couple of those committee members have some concerns with perhaps parts of the standard, then they would write out their reasons for having some concerns. The committee would have to consider that. And sometimes they change the standard. Sometimes they say, no, we've heard you, but that's not, we're not going to change it. We're going to stay on the current standard. And so consensus is everybody on the committee has a voice. All the concerns of everybody on the committee are dealt with one way or another, and then they can proceed.
Can I use an example here for how standards are achieved? For something that is contentious, a product that's contentious, like traditional medicine, for example, do you set a standard so that it's not harmful, or do you also look and see whether it's effective and it works and it actually does what the product claims it do?
Well, there is an international standard being developed for traditional medicine. And so I'm speaking about something that isn't finished. The purpose, they would set out the purpose from the very beginning. It would certainly include anything to do with harm. So the first thing would be none of this should create any harm to the person using it. But it would also move into what are the benefits of such a product, and would likely then have something against which a consumer could measure success.
So I want to come back to the point you mentioned earlier in the first part that most of the time it's the smaller countries that are not members to ISO. And it is said that standards will help developing countries grow more with less. Can you elaborate on how this happens?
Yeah, you know, developing countries... let me put it this way. Whether you're a developed or a developing country, the national standards issues are probably the same. So Canada's a developed country. I meet with my colleagues here in Malaysia. We're talking about the same issues. There's really no difference in we're having trouble getting the attention of governments and with industries. We're having trouble telling people the value of standards. So we've all got the same issues. What's happening now is Malaysia or any developing country, any small country, if it needs a standard, then they're going to have to create it on their own. That takes an awful lot of work, and it means that we're using more resources. There's more people involved, et cetera. By moving to international standards, they don't need to put the same resources into that. If I was in Malaysia, I would say, if we're looking at a standard, is there an international standard that Malaysia can use? If yes, then let's put our Malaysian experts on those technical committees so that when we have information that we want into that standard, we get it in there. Then when the standard is published, we can say, we know what happened, we had input, and now that standard can be used in Malaysia, and that's an awful lot less use of resources than creating something on our own.
According to your website, about 8 technical meetings are taking place somewhere in the world every day. Do you personally oversee the end result of everything?
No.
Is there a QC process?
No, I'm not in charge of quality control. Yes, that's a good point. Those technical committees are meeting constantly. But within ISO, we have a technical management board. And it is made up of countries that are elected and thus appointed to oversee that whole system. And they have many, many processes outlining the way in which a standard can be developed. We will appoint a chair of a technical committee. There will be a secretariat that's responsible for ensuring that all of the process steps are met. The consensus is reached, for example. And so they're the ones who, the technical management board, who give approval to the standard to be developed and then published.
Yeah, all this requires a lot of money, isn't it? And ISO is a non-governmental, non-profit. What funds the work that ISO do?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And most of the work is funded by the countries who send the technical experts to the committees. So that we do bring in funding from the sale of standards. About 2/3 of our revenue comes from the membership fees, so that Malaysia, Canada, we pay fees to belong to ISO. And the other third comes from the sale of standards and various products. The work, though, Malaysia carries a number of secretariats, will have a number of memberships, the chairmanships of the committees. All of that will be funded either by the Malaysian government or more likely by Malaysian industry, who see a need to be there. So a huge amount of work and cost is put in by the industries and the governments and the stakeholders. I worked for an organization in Canada where we used to say it cost us $30 million a year, Canadian dollars, to develop all of the standards that were used. But we assumed that industry put in another $70 million on top of that in time at committee meetings and in writing documents. So a huge amount comes from outside ISO.
The private sector.
Yes.
Right. ISO turned 70 this year. Do you think enough of the public know what ISO do?
Oh, no.
Yeah. Like
that's why we're here. No.
Because there's no crisis. Unless there's a crisis, people news are driven by bad news, right?
Yes.
Newspapers, they don't tell you that, look, your elevator is working perfectly fine.
No, I don't. I think that's the problem. I would guess, as in Canada, that Malaysia is the same. Not many people understand what Standards Malaysia does. They don't understand what ISO does. The best recognition we used to get was the initial ISO 9000. And you might remember where there would be big banners on companies where they were ISO 9000 certified. That at least raised the issue of what did that mean. There was a management system standard that was very popular, still very popular. And so there was some recognition that way. But most people don't understand it.
Is it okay that way, that people don't understand it?
Maybe. Maybe it is. My belief is that if the leaders of governments and the leaders of industries understand the value of standards, then they will continue to use and support and the public will be safe. But do the citizens of the country need to have a great level of understanding of ISO or Standards Malaysia? Probably not. They just need to have some faith that they should know a little bit about it, and they should know that the system works, and they should continue to support it.
But that's the thing, isn't it? Because politicians are driven by their constituents' interests, and so if they're not making noise about it, it would not be perceived as a priority. And ISO, I think it's I think you consider yourself the establishment, right? And anti-establishment sentiments are very high.
Yes.
Around the globe at the moment. So do you think you have to address this trust deficit?
Yes, certainly, because you're right, that whole anti-establishment mentality is really spreading. But what would worry me would be if we didn't support these standards, because then we would have a crisis. In Canada many years ago, we had a crisis in the handling of blood and blood products, and we were then given authority by the government to create a new standard for the handling of blood and blood products. That brought it to the attention of the public. But again, it was only a crisis. So those who believe we don't need standards and are anti-establishment don't have a good understanding of why they are healthy and safe every day because of standards. It's as I said to you at the very beginning, and I say this sometimes when I'm speaking to people as sort of a joke. If I'm speaking to 400 or 500 people, I ask them, when they got out of bed this morning and turned on the light, how many of them were electrocuted? And nobody has ever put their hand up yet. So I say, that's great, and that's because there's a standard. And then we talk about they went to the bank and they got money out, and that's a standard. They rode an elevator upstairs to their office. That's another standard. The food that they had at the end of the day probably meets another standard. So it's... standards are pervasive in our society. They provide a wonderful society. We just don't understand how much they do for us.
Thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
John Walter is the president-elect, soon to be president of the ISO, International Organization for Standardization. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.